The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 292.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He really needs no introduction. His name is Keith McCullough. Keith, welcome back, my friend.
Thank you for having me, my man.
I just got done listening to your conversation with Rickards. That was fantastic. So if people aren't subscribed to your YouTube channel, they definitely need to do that first and foremost. But before I want to get into that conversation, but before we do, I want to ask you, is it a prerequisite for making money in the stock market to own a fleece vest?
Yes.
That's what I thought.
I got to tell my today I went with like the Ryder Cup performance fleece. So I've upgraded a little bit, you know.
Yeah. Whenever I look at guys from Connecticut that are in the market, that's like the go-to uniform. They've always got to wear the nice collared shirt, but then have the fleece vest over the top of it. So now that we understand that, that's probably the biggest secret of Keith McCullough's success. Let's dive into some maybe more important topics. Let's start with Evergrande. I think that's kind of on everyone's mind. I'm sure you guys have done a lot of research there. What are your thoughts on Evergrande right now?
Hey, to me, it's every time you get a major economy slowing or collapsing, you end up with some kind of thing that's happening metaphorically that comes closer, maybe not to the end of the movie, but it's certainly perpetuating the movie. So, like when you go back to China, they really started slowing on a longer term basis going all the way back to, the financial crisis. So if you go back and then you look at 2017, when their economy put in a cyclical peak, or the most recent cyclical peak, which was coming out of the pandemic, which was in the first quarter of this year, our call was that China was going to slow and then slow quite quickly. So now it's actually slowing quite quickly, right on the screws when we thought it would, into the back half of this year. And then you see the weakest companies, or as you would know, the most levered companies in a weakening economy, are the ones that end up looking the worst. So I definitely don't, and if you want to go there, I don't believe that there's like worldwide contagion. It's kind of crazy that it was only a week ago today that like a lot of people thought that the sky was falling and that you had to raise cash. I'm definitely not at that camp.
Yeah. So what's your time frame, Keith? Let's establish that first and foremost, because I know you got some pushback with Rickards because you might be in the stagflation camp. And I think he's in the deflation camp. And you're saying, oh, listen, it's just a matter of time frame. It's not that I, fundamentally disagree with him. So when you say you're making the calls, what type of time frame are you guys usually working with?
Well, I'm always working with the intermediate term trend within the what I call the long term tail. So my intermediate term trend I define as 3 months or more. So you got to be at least a quarterly investor, a long short, to have that type of an outlook. And then long term tail risk, 3 years or less. I'm not one of these intellects that can tell you what's going to happen beyond 3 years from now. So, and again, it's just the way that my machine and my system works. So again, I've have a long history of being both positioned for inflation and deflation. I'm currently still on the inflation side with a global inflation outlook that should peak within the next 3 to 6 months. And we'll have to see if I have to change my view on that. That's highly dependent on what things that are inflating are doing. Don't forget that things like oil are back at 75 today. If they bust the move to new 3-year highs, that's going to make me more hawkish on inflation. But again, at some point by the second quarter of next year is the general point that that I think Jim and I will agree that I'm going to be making a disinflation and or a deflation of the inflation call. But again, you got to inflate before you deflate. And that's the whole point about timing. Timing obviously matters. I'm very active in the market and I want to get, if I could get every move right, I would. I obviously don't, but that's the goal.
Yeah. So when we're talking about inflation or deflation, I think that when I talk about it, I try to compartmentalize it, because the real question is the dollar against what? So The dollar against assets, as an example, the dollar against goods and services domestically, or the dollar against other currencies, notably the DXY. So when you're talking about a deflation or disinflation or inflation, do you guys normally use that term to talk about asset markets or consumer price inflation, or the dollar globally, or kind of a little bit of both?
Both, or all of it in between. I mean, and there can be, as you know, there can be divergences within those things. Yeah. So again, of course, everything that I measure and map in all of global macro across 50 different countries, whether they be the bond markets, stock markets, commodity markets, they're all denominated in dollars. So I always talk in DXY terms. So there's that, you know, there's making money on that, which is a real important thing. And then there's, you know, the more, I guess, the more arcane government calculations or suggestions of what inflation is, like headline CPI. But my model front run uses actually real world commodity prices to front run headline inflation or CPI. So I do both. My nowcast for U.S. inflation in particular is going towards the cycle highs. Currently, we have that going to new cycle highs in China, new cycle highs in Europe. So again, that's largely a function, George, of what real world prices are doing in dollars. So, yeah, right. You know, I think you do need to tie the two together, because if you can't, A, you're going to have a hell of a time making money. B, you're going to sound like you're telling a lot of stories, which is like not what I prefer to start with. You know, I want to tell you a narrative after my numbers tell you that, as opposed to start with a narrative telling inflation what to do, or headline reported inflation, what it will or will not do. The transitory word comes to mind in that case.
Yeah. So let's go into the commodities, because obviously they're priced in dollars. I think we've had maybe a little bit of pullback in most things other than oil due to what's happening in China. You're saying that that's maybe kind of overblown. So do you see this as a buying opportunities for broad-based commodities?
Yeah, Monday of last week was a wonderful buying opportunity in pretty much everything that I like. So again, as opposed to, you know, freaking out, I mean, we were buying the damn dip. I covered most of my shorts. My biggest shorts, by the way, have been China, Hong Kong, South Korea. So again, I always say, if you're so bearish on China, fucking short China. Like, I mean, that's a very pretty simple call. But on the other side of it, take people's bearishness on China. And I wasn't buying copper. I don't like buying the things that the Chinese are explicitly selling, like 30 tons at a time on certain dates, like they did copper on September the 1st. That said, copper would be the last one to break out again, I think, that, you know, amidst all the other things that are breaking out. We're long big time natural gas. I think that that's going to six at least in the short term in the USA, and it could go to eight quite quickly after that. As you know, European gas prices are a lot higher than that. Oil, we're still bullish on that. You know, things like cotton went to new cycle highs this morning. You're getting more and more of these breakouts. People started saying, well, look at lumber. Now we got deflation back. And then lumber goes up 30% in the last month and nobody talks about it anymore. So that's the thing about broadening inflation in things that are priced in dollars. They're really taking turns. And I don't really care what commodity. I call Bitcoin a commodity, for God's sakes. I mean, I'll buy any commodity in dollars if I get it at the low end of my risk range. And that's what I've been basically doing since June. We've been long commodities and short dollars since June of 2020. So it's been a good run. And I still think people don't understand it fully, or they'd be, you know, more people would be talking about trending inflation because they'd be long it instead of it talking about or arguing about being transitory.
So when does that cycle shift and why does it shift? And I'm assuming that you're in the camp that maybe we have stagflation for the next 6 months, the next year, but long-term, these deflationary pressures that exist in the United States as a result of just everyone's balance sheet being over-levered are going to take over. So I guess what's your time frame there, and what's the catalyst for the cycle changing?
Well, the catalyst for prices to go down is that they went up. Let's just start with that. So, you know, that's my main catalyst. The higher prices go, the more likely it is that we get a collapse from inflated prices. On the calendar, though, it's Q2 of next year. And the main reason for that is that we're going to see an actual real growth slowdown alongside a breakdown in inflation. A lot of that is largely due to the base effects, which seemingly everybody understands now, but they don't know how to use it. Base effects have gotten tougher here in the third quarter, but inflation went higher against steepening base effects. What's going to happen next year by the second quarter is that the base effects are the steepest that they've been in the history of base effects. Mm-hmm. So that's a very good spot to be paying attention to that. There's also the very high probability that the Fed makes a mistake and tightens into what I think will be a robust U.S. economy in the fourth quarter. So that could be another catalyst, or it could be anything. I mean, a bird could fly into a building, and that you might call that the catalyst. These days, people pick up on any narrative, but that's my timeline.
How do wages play into that? And because what I'm thinking through is you've got 11 million job openings. I think that's an all-time high in the United States. You have a lot of people that just aren't going back to work. I don't know if it's a result of stimmy checks. I don't know if it's a result of their crypto trading's going to the moon, or the stock market's at all-time high, so they can afford to be a little bit more picky and choosy. But that's driving wages up. So would that potentially create a positive or a feedback loop higher with the inflation towards more sustainable.
Yeah, that like that's where the more sustainable or structural, you'd still have to call it cyclical if you're talking about labor, but you could have some structure to wage inflation that sticks, you know, and you just rattled off more than a couple things there that really have mattered. And behaviorally, like, what do I know? I think that a lot of things that you could say can make some sense. You made a couple good points, you know, there. You could also say that the labor market starts to pick up a little bit more robustly here in the coming months. There's some, you know, kind of bean counting factors there that depressed the most recent labor report, where I think it got people maybe too bearish on labor. So we're looking for labor to accelerate in terms of employment gains, but you're definitely going to get higher wages because workers are demanding it. You can look at any JOLTS report, quit rates in America. You know, employees are cocky and they're demanding to get paid more, and they will get paid more. So that's going to create, you know, the problem with that, of course, George, as you know, when the top line or revenues, GDP and revenues slow in the second quarter and third quarter of next year, that you have higher cost structures, that stagflation in your P&L. So again, that's when you get, and going back to when I created the quad model, this came from company models. So I used to call them, or still call them, we call them the pods. So pod one is revenue growth. Pod two, at a very basic level, is your margins and or cash flow growth. So your cash flows are just going to be falling at a faster rate because you have higher costs of labor and revenues are finally slowing as opposed to accelerating. In the fourth quarter here, I think, again, Wall Street's too bearish on fourth quarter GDP and revenue growth. So I think that, you know, there's a couple careers, you know, between now and that call that I'm going to make there. I want to, you know, I want to make as much money as I can being long growth and inflation here in the fourth quarter.
Right. So a safe summary would be, okay, longer term, that these wages are going to put pressure on margins, and therefore that's going to affect the broad S&P. But until that time, there's still room to run.
Well, in the meantime, there are some companies, George, that I'm short, that, you know, we have plenty of great short ideas that are, you know, basically like companies that are melting ice cubes, right? They're the ones that right now, no matter what quad you're in, they have no pricing power. Think consumer staples, for example. Think Verizon or telecom cable providers. You know, I love to compete with CNBC, of course. I mean, these kinds of channels are a joke. I mean, there's no pricing. There's no nothing there. There's just rising costs. Right. So there are sectors in the economy to be short, you know, and some people are actually long these sectors because they think they're defensive. You know, it's offensive for people to not get that very basic, you know, reality of company dynamics, where again, you have no pricing power and you have rising costs. Therefore, you're going to start to show decelerating, you know, earnings growth. And I do think that those are still some, no matter what the market's doing, they've been good relative shorts, but they might just be some of the best absolute shorts too.
Okay, so let's go back to commodities. I know a lot of my viewers and listeners are interested in oil. How do you think the ESG narrative will play out longer term with oil? Because I think people really get hyper-focused on the demand side, but they forget the supply side of that equation.
Yeah, what would the rebel capitalists know about the government screwing something else up here with this damn ESG? it's you and I will laugh, but they don't laugh. I mean, they're very nervous about this right now. I mean, the supply side is critical for people to say that there's only inflation because of pandemic related supply chain gluts, et cetera, et cetera. That's complete bullshit. I mean, the fact of the matter is that we've basically trained our dragons, both in Europe and, well, Canada, Europe, you know, not to pick on the Europeans, the Canadian can say the same thing, or most obviously in the USA as well. What you've done is you disincentivize, you know, capacity buildouts and actually, you know, real, you know, capacity that can come online when you end up with a situation like this. So we've disincentivized that for a long, long time. Anyone can look at a CapEx chart on resources in particular since 2016. That's where they bloody well got rid of the energy industry and replaced it with ESG, which was complete bullshit too. I mean, there are companies out there that make aluminum cans that they call ESG now in their presentation.
Yeah,
you know, there's freaking plastic inside the can. Like, what the hell? I mean, it's like, you know, so again, this has created a lot of unintended consequences. One of the most obvious examples, which is readily, you know, on everybody's screen today, but again, it's a function of all the policy that came before it, are basically these carbon points that you were getting in Europe. I mean, this is crazy. They have the highest electricity prices in Europe this morning, today, tomorrow afternoon, ever. Like, ever's a long time.
Yeah, right. It's amazing they can't connect those dots. I just saw a consumer credit card that was coming out called Duconomy. And what it does is it tracks all of your monthly spending and then gives you a carbon score at the end of the month. And I said, well, that I'm sure that's going to be great when the government gets control of that, you know, and gives you demerit points for buying that extra steak that does, you know, this much damage to the ecosystem or something like that. But that's a whole different topic. You know, so you're talking about stagflation, Keith. What's going on with the long end of the yield curve? What is the long end not getting, or is it just demand from all the Fed buying the treasuries with $120 billion worth of QE a month?
Well, there's a huge pivot that the market just made. The bond market got it, you know, big time. And it's what's really interesting, again, is people running around with their hair on fire last Monday on China saying that everything was going to slow again right at the bottom of it all in terms of bond yields. So one, like just to review, like in our framework, the quads, you know, quad three stagflation. When you say stagflation, I see that. I see rising inflation and slowing real growth. That's quad three. Bond yields, let's use the 10-year as an example, are downward sloping in that quad, and the yield curve has a central tendency to compress. So 10s, 2s got all the way down, 10-year yield minus 2-year yield got all the way down to like 104, 105 basis points during that quad three stagflation of the third quarter. Why did we have quad three stagflation? One big reason was the variant. You can have variant narratives, I like to say, about the variant, but the variant definitely had impact in the month of August. Every single rate of change data series that we measure in MAP and macro went down. Now they're starting to go back up as the Delta variant narratives go the other way alongside the variant, you know. So what I think just happened in bond yields is critical. I think the fourth quarter, you're going to have a reacceleration in demand that reflects the inverse of COVID cases, which is now an empirical fact, both globally and locally, but very obvious in the U.S. And it doesn't take
consumer demand.
And there's a lot of pent up demand, but there's also just you lock people down right when they didn't want to get locked down, and they have to comply. Like try living in the great, you know, state of Connecticut. I mean, it was brutal. Now, so the whole point on why are bond yields breaking out? I think it's because the economy is going to accelerate in the fourth quarter. That might just be it for a quarter or two. Again, I reserve the inalienable right until I'm never going to live in China where somebody removes that right for me to say that. But the fact of the matter is that I think that bond yields could go to 175 on the 10-year in fairly short order for a lot of reasons. People are bearish on growth. They're bullish on duration. They're long the dollar. They're short the Russell 2000. There's a lot of things that consensus has set up with, which I think could be very wrong quickly in bond yield space. That would be called quad two when you have growth and inflation accelerating at the same time, which is not stagflation. It's like get out there, buy GameStop and party.
So at what point does the 10-year get high enough to where it would affect the stock market to the point where the Fed would have to step in and do something? Now, whether they can do something or not, who knows? But where they would actually try to, you know, increase the quantitative easing or create some other 4 or 5 letter program, buy stocks, who knows? But I just think that the economy now is just so dependent upon asset prices and the stock market and real estate just going up and up and up, that if we have a downturn of, let's say, 20%, they're going to have to come in and do something. So, and obviously the 10-year might prompt them to do that. So how high do you think it can go?
Yeah, well, it's a really important question, obviously. And never forget that the long end of the bond market does what the economy is doing, not what the Fed tells it to do. The short end, yeah, is what the Fed's trying to instruct on a very obvious lag to economic reality. So again, you know, multiple things can happen all the time. So again, let's just start with that. There's a November meeting, which I got my eyes squarely on. I do think that the stock market and commodities will hit new cycle highs, all-time highs in the case of the stock market, NASDAQ fully loaded, you know, throughout that period. And they could quite easily do what they should have done, which is been hawkish already and most likely already raising interest rates. Now, one point on that, a very important point, is that when the economy is in quad two, interest rates rising, stocks rising, and the Fed raising interest rates can all happen at the same time. It happened in 2013. We made that call. It happened in 2017. We made that call. In 2017, people are like, oh, that's because you like Trump. It's like, bullshit. I hate the guy. It's like, no, it's, you know, and it can happen in the fourth quarter of this year. Now, the problem is when the Fed gets cocky with that and or, you know, cocksure of themselves about that. And then they start and they give you outlooks on interest rate hikes into the beginning of 2022 when we're going to slow again. Because a Federal Reserve that tightens into a slowdown creates a crash in the U.S. stock market. So that's definitely my case for a crash, is that we need to go up first. Like I said, the catalyst to go down is that you went up. And then it's the Fed is pervasively hawkish into growth slowing next year. But I think what's happening right now, and the narrative is going to be, by the way, it's predictable. Interest rates went up, so the mega caps went down for like a day. That's not what happened Friday. I mean, that's not what happened last week. Bond yields were up. Stocks were up. Tech was up. You know, if they go up too fast, then, yeah, you're going to have some sensitivity to that. But if the economy is accelerating, that's the key. The Fed can actually be hawkish and it won't matter.
Okay, so do you think they'll express that hawkishness just by tapering, so doing less of QE, or do you think that they'll actually raise rates?
I mean, these guys are like, the only thing that's predictable is if Powell wants his, you know, to maintain his job. I mean, like, he wants to be popular, he wants to do whatever he did. I mean, his two most recent, you know, Jackson Hole and the most recent September Fed meeting, I mean, he was definitely dovish relative to the economic data on the inflation front. In fact, I thought he was completely full of shit on multiple fronts. I mean, he basically identified used car prices as an example, which is like a de minimis amount of the headline CPI, where you have U.S. rent, which is a third of the CPI, and ramming Americans a new one. I mean, he didn't even discuss that, or the Fed's influence on that, or asset prices, or how it's going to flow. They have a bloody well Dallas Fed paper out on it now, saying that home price inflation is going to perpetuate rents of up 7 towards 8% by 2023. So he knows that. He just doesn't talk about it. So, you know, there are a couple of things that are hard in this business, which are calling a parting of the heavens, calling, you know, a Fed statement like on the date that he's actually going to say it. I my style is actually to wake up, God willing, 2 feet on the floor every day, and just reading and reacting to where the market is into these catalysts. So I think it matters a lot more into the November meeting where the market is, what he says relative to what I could tell you he could or should or would want to say today.
Yeah, I just, you know, to raise rates, you would assume that they would have to completely stop quantitative easing altogether. And I just,
good point.
I can't see a world where that doesn't implode the stock market and you know, have them right back to where we were at $120 billion a month, if not more.
Right. Well, you say that, and you're not exactly. I don't think that the rebel capitalist is a Federal Reserve fan, but you know, it's like what's his name, Williams, the other suit that's sitting there in New York at the New York Fed today. He basically said, look, you know, there's no tapering, but there's no real bar here that's been crossed for a rate hike. But if they did raise rates, George, they damn well blow up the whole world. Like, you want to blow up the stock market, just have Powell try it. Just come out come out tomorrow and say you're going to raise rates. You know, things will collapse. The tapestry of this thing is thinly veiled, suffice to say. So I don't think I don't think that they're going to do that, but you never know.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Let's talk about real estate for a moment. I know that's another hot topic for my viewers and listeners. So you talked about an interesting dynamic where home prices are just going to the moon, but yet we see rents doing the exact same thing. You know, usually we have, if home prices go too high, then people just start renting. And if rents go too high, then they start buying. because it makes more financial sense. So you get this kind of equilibrium. But now they're just both going up. And I don't know, I've studied a little bit of history enough to know that the two things that really trigger social unrest are when food prices increased or when people can't afford to put a roof over their head. So I guess, where do you see the whole real estate market going? And then, you know, how do you think that'll apply to society?
Yeah, I think you make some really important points there about the people versus, you know, the establishment and what really pisses them off. I mean, nothing. I mean, there are very few things. Like, I grew up in Thunder Bay, Ontario. My dad was a firefighter, and it didn't mean that we were like lower middle class. I was quite happy to be part of the human race. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, there's certain big things like the roof over our head and the food that we're eating every day that matter more than other things, right? So I think that that's an important point that somebody like you with a leadership voice is able to say, and I don't think we can say that enough. So, you know, just keeping that, you know, in our back pocket. I still think that, like, if you start to, so we built basically a rent tracker by American City, because I'm not going to take the government's word for it. I mean, we have modern tools and technology where you can measure and map that. And I was just like, just looking at it just now when you asked the question, because it just came to mind. I mean, we have year for the month of August, you know, the rate of change, the year over year rate of change of rental growth is like running 29.5% year over year in Tampa, Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, it's not just Tampa. I could pick Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, Miami, obviously everybody knows, but what you're seeing is a broadening to, you know, Raleigh, Charlotte, Arizona. You know, these are between 15 and 30% year over year rent hikes. And there are a lot of reasons for that, right? The ability to basically kick people out finally and then take the new people in at a higher rent, for example. But there's the number one leading indicator for all this. You know this because you know real estate. The number one leading indicator for rent is home prices by a six-month lag, six-month lead at least. And this was actually the subject matter of even the Dallas Fed's paper that they just put out. It's like, oh, look at HPI, home price inflation. It's running at like 18% year over year. And the owner's equivalent rent in the CPI is like down here. So, you know, something's going to break and we already know what it is. The prices broke to the upside. And the next part of it is people are going to be pissed off.
Yeah. So just, I'm curious. I did a story the other day or a video, and I used numbers from realtor.com. It said okay. The trailing 12 months was up about 12%. That was for all states. And that was the past 12 months. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you've got data on a state per state level. And I'd be curious, yep. It sounds like all those states that you mentioned are the ones where, let's say they have a little bit more freedom,
yep.
for lack of a better word. So we've got the yep. Texas, we've got the Arizona, we've got the Florida. What's happening in states like California, Oregon, New York? Are you seeing the rent increase as much or a little bit lower?
A little bit lower, but like looking at this, Anaheim's 15%, Los Angeles is 5%, San Diego's 16%, San Jose's 3%. So you get like kind of high-low situation in California, whereas, like you said, maybe where there's a little bit more freedom and mobility, lower taxes, you get those states have a much more broad base. Like the state of Florida is the best example.
Yeah.
So if you had a house and you just sold it because you never thought you could sell it for that price, okay, great. Like my parents did, you know, sell their house. Now they got to rent. Well, guess what? Everybody's got the same idea. And then you see a broadening. Like, it's not right. Like Sarasota, Florida was in a boom up until most recently, but you know, it keeps pushing to the places where the inflation was not because people want to live in Florida. So that's, I think that these things are trivial matters to anybody who's data driven. But again, what you use on a 12-month look back is really interesting too, because, you know, I'm using the August year over year numbers as the, you know, tip of the spear. And every month, you know, we'll update it as we get new data, but those numbers really feed the extension on how long this can go. And again, when people have a view on CPI going back towards the Fed's target of 2%, which is mathematically impossible, by the way, if what we just talked about holds.
Because CPI or because of housing is such a major component of the CPI.
Right. It's a third of the CPI. Think of normal people, like the people that listen to you and I, like normal human beings, not the people that live in the ivory tower of the Fed. Normal people know that this is the biggest cost center, at least one of them, of their life. And it's definitely not going away.
So how do you play that from an investment standpoint? And then I guess what would be the solution from a government standpoint? I think it'd just be lower regulations to incentivize the home builders to build quote unquote affordable housing. It's got to be profitable yep. for them. If it's not profitable, they won't do it. But I'd right. like to get your view on that.
Well, we're definitely going to get that with this administration. And a lot of the home price, HPI, home price inflation that we've seen since the pandemic is in the, called the middle to top tier of homes, yeah. right? So affordable housing and all the, there's a whole bunch of things like, you know, again, giving students, rebates or free money, you know, first time home buyer tax credits, all these different things that I don't want to go into explaining because I'm not the government. But the fact of the matter is that is, they do consider that a big opportunity in terms of votes. Millennial votes ahead of the midterm election, right? I mean, that's not a political comment. That I think most Democrats would say that's a damn good political strategy. So that's going to go on, and I think that you're going to still sit here. You're going to see this gargantuan amount of demand. You also have Wall Street, you know, whether it be Blackstone, Cerberus, or whoever. The stocks that we like are doing the same thing. American Homes for Rent, AMH, pretty simple example. Or if you want to like get into something like Avalon Bay, I mean, these are REITs that we like. We still like REITs. We prefer to be long residential. Okay. If I can be long single family, I am. So personally, I've been buying more real estate or investing in deals where, you know, it's a single project or single unit type opportunity. Cause you know, as you know, because it's so hard to get these things built with all the supply shortages, whoever's got the newest capacity gets to take the most price next. And that's the other big obvious thing that's going on in the real estate market, particularly on the luxury side.
Okay. So I want to make a shift from real estate and kind of go back to the dollar. Because I know that's kind of your main thesis is that you got to get the dollar right. Yeah. If you get the dollar right, then it makes life a lot easier. If you get it wrong, then you're most likely going to be losing money. So you see the dollar on the DXY going down over the next, let's say, 6 months to a year. Do you have some sort of range there? Do you think it could get down to 85 or 80, or do you just see it coming down below 90?
Yeah, that would be, if we got to 80, 85, you'd be looking at north, you know, triple digit oil price. I mean, that'd be fun. The correlation on oil or the S&P 500 for that matter to the dollar, if you look at a short term duration, like 2 to 3 weeks, you're talking about like inversely correlated 0.9. So doing the opposite a lot of the time. So that I don't have. The duration on it too is the other interesting one. Like I only think the dollar stays flat to down, which is basically what it's done. Most recently, it just hasn't gone up. It's flat to down and maybe down a little faster here in the next 3 to 6 months. Okay. And then from whatever point that is, you know, when we hit quad four deflation, I go long the dollar and short everything that I'm long currently. Like I do the opposite. That's why some people like Hedgeye Nation, Hedgeye.com, because I go both ways. So I like it. You know, it's like you got to be able to do that. You got to understand if you get the dollar right, like to your point, you get a lot of other things right. So by Q2 of next year, and again, I don't know if it's going to start in Q2 or it's going to start in the 6 weeks that are left in the first quarter, the dollar's either going to signal it's done going down from, like, I currently don't have it going down below 90 on the US dollar index. So no on that. If it were, then I'd just do what the market's doing. Because again, I don't know. I just do what it's doing. And I think that that's important just for people to consider, right? Like, I mean, you don't have to do it the way I do it, but just consider it that way, as opposed to being ideological with some milkshake theory on what the dollar can or may not do. Like, why don't you just do what it's doing? You know, so again, whatever it's doing from that point sideways to down. And again, I don't, at least my model currently doesn't expect, or my signal doesn't expect to break down through 90 on the US dollar index. Then from there, it could actually go up pretty quickly and not up for any other reason that people are trying to raise cash and get the hell out of markets that are collapsing.
Yeah. So, and just to be clear there, guys, what we've shifted, we were talking about consumer price inflation. Now we're talking about the dollar on the DXY, which is basically the dollar against a basket of currencies, of other fiat currencies, most notably the euro. I think the euro is 57%. So yep. That takes me back to China, because if let's just assume that China goes into a recession, you said you're actually, before we get there, Keith, why are you bearish on China longer term? Let's start there and then kind of work backwards.
It's the easiest short since Japan, I mean, which was a pretty easy short, or in the case of JGBs, a great bull case for JGBs. Remember how many years, George, people were like, oh, you gotta short those JGBs. They're at a valuation that's unsustainable.
Didn't they call that the Widowmaker trade? Isn't that the Widowmaker? I think so.
But, you know, the number one reason to be short Japan over the years, like, I mean, I'm talking about 30 years, was demographics. So you have two big reasons to keep this simple on short China. One, on the industrial side, or old China, you know, they peaked after they entered the WTO and big time and have been slowing ever since. You've had industrial production rally cyclically, which is what rallies in a downward sloping long-term line. So when you take a 3 to 6 to 10 year view on China from here, there's a very high probability that their industrial growth decelerates and decelerates at a faster rate. That's right. The old China. On new China, the demographics are the worst in the world. I mean, the one-child policy is coming home to roost. The propensity of the consumer to consume, i.e. their capacity to consume, their demand to consume, is going down as the population ages. If you look at, you know, the 35 to 55-year-olds are your biggest spenders in an economy because they got kids, they got all the bills. And that cohort is slowing big time to negative year-over-year growth as well. So you got, when you have both the old part of the economy, or the cyclical part of the economy, and the consumer part of the economy slowing, and the government's going to regulate your ass like they're doing right now, it's just not good.
Yeah. So my thought process when you outline that is China having less consumer demand, therefore they're importing less. Now, we all know China's a huge exporter, but no one really talks about how much they import. And according to my research, they import about $2 trillion worth of stuff every single year. So if they're importing less stuff, the majority of that stuff is settled in dollars. So therefore, fewer dollars are going outside of Japan. And I'm thinking about the global dollar-denominated debt. And then I'm thinking, okay, with those dollar-denominated cash flows reduced significantly, now all of a sudden, if you're a corporate entity in Colombia, let's say, you don't have as much dollar cash flow, so you've got to take your peso cash flow and sell those pesos to get the dollars you need to pay down the dollar-denominated debt. And now, all of a sudden, you have a lot more demand for dollars, a lot more supply of these other currencies, which could maybe add another tailwind to what you were saying with the dollar going down to 90, but then starting to go back up to, who knows,
105.
We could get up to 100 again.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, anytime you have a one of the keys to what you just said, the fulcrum point is the debt, right? The debt is the fulcrum point.
Yeah.
The debt is going to be deflated in dollars cyclically. It doesn't have to be deflated on the timeline that somebody writes a book about it or wants to be famous about it or whatever. That's not what markets do. You know, so, you know, the fact of the matter is the biggest deflationary scares that we've had have been defined explicitly by a shortage of dollars and dollar denominated debt. That's right on the screws, right? And it doesn't matter till it starts to matter. Currently, you know, dollars, I mean, think about it, like to your point, in euros, almost 60% of the US dollar index is indeed the euro. And the European economy is going to rip in the next two quarters. Like, don't forget that they delayed their reopening more so than we did, and they had more regulation.
Yeah, I remember hearing you say that you are bullish on the European market.
Right. So I do think that Europe's going to be a lot stronger than people think. In fact, like our fourth quarter GDP numbers, almost, the Atlanta Fed's at like 3.5% growth. We're at 6 going towards 7. But in Europe, like, we're already at 6. We have European growth going from basically 2 to 4 to 6, almost 7% GDP growth in the next two quarters. And most people are like, this is Europe. How's that possible? Well, we'll see. And that would be bullish for that'd be bullish for the euro.
Right. That's why short term dollar going down maybe, but then longer term that starts to settle down. You know, they get that 6% growth rate, then it goes down back down to
four, maybe three.
Then you have the structural issues kick in, which then tilts the boat in favor of the dollar again.
Yeah, that's so if you stay on my timeline and you fully load up what you said about US dollar denominated debt, and we go to the second quarter of next year and the euro is coming off like a material level, like 141, 142, a level that it's had a hard time sustaining anyway, from a mean reversion perspective. And then the euro starts going down because Europe slows off its cycle peak. There's another reason why the dollar can go up.
Okay, let's move on to another topic I think you might've touched on with Rickards, but I'd love to get your view on just in general, central bank digital currency and the probability that we have that here in the United States. I think if you look at Lacey Hunt's argument, I think this is kind of Jim's argument as well for being very long-term deflationary. As you just look at the balance sheets, commercial banks really don't have anyone to lend to. And if the commercial banks lend less, then there's fewer dollars created. And it just goes back to that dollar-denominated debt thing that we were talking about, but just domestically instead of instead of internationally. So I think that the Fed might know they're kind of held hostage to a certain point regarding the amount of dollars that they can get in the real economy circulating with velocity, chasing goods and services or on the balance sheet of non-bank entities. And so they're like, okay, how do we control that? You know, because we got to bail out the government, who's the biggest debtor of all time. And we can only do that through inflation. So that's why I think there's a high probability that we get a central bank digital currency. So to Dr. Lacey Hunt's point, they can take bank reserves and turn them into legal tender. So everyone's got a bank account with the Fed. They give you your stimmy check on your app, you know, and basically people are spending bank reserves as dollars circulating in the real economy, where right now they can't do that. So that's kind of my take on it, but I'd love to get your take.
Yeah, I haven't thought it through that coherently. I mean, but I could see it. Like when somebody, you know, thoughtful tells me a story like that within the context of what I know, that's absolutely doable. I mean, and Lacey Hunt obviously is obviously somebody that most people should pay attention to when he's thinking things through. But when you, like, if you just shape shift this into the middle of the next or the middle of this administration's tenure, and we do have a slowdown against the mother of all economic accelerations, which was against the mother of all pandemics. You get a pandemic is the worst it is. Now it looks as good as it's going to look. Then it's going to be bad for the back half of the Democrats' reign. I mean, you could see them thinking up pretty much anything. Like, I mean, including that. Why wouldn't that be part of MMT? What better way for Kelton to express her views? Or Janet Yellen, by the way. She believes in, if you really listen to her, she's like a raging socialist. I mean, she's like, talks about the decency of a living wage. And when she grew up in Brooklyn, everyone should have had a job. I'm like, not where I grew up. I mean, it's like, you know, and I lived in Canada. I mean, it's like, you don't, I think there is limitless, they'll call this at the Fed, Bernanke, you know, was really the main storyteller on this, hook, line, sinker. He'll call it innovation at the Fed. They'll call it something like that. And, you know, AOC and everybody in that party, they'll be like, yeah, this is how we get the money directly into, and I think this was Rickard's point too. I mean, to get the money directly into the accounts of the people that can vote for us.
Yeah, Brainerd's talk about that a lot. And and by the way, I don't know if you saw AOC and Elizabeth Warren, I think Sanders and all those types, they came out and criticized Jerome Powell for not being dovish enough.
Yeah. Well, that's like, you want to listen to, you know, to Prince, you know, it's just like what it sounds like when these doves are crying. But the fact, this is, you know, for guys our age, we at least get that joke, right?
It's like,
but you're that's the thing with Powell. I don't know what you think about it, but I mean, I to me, it's a little weird that he wants to stay in this. Like, why do you want the job again? Are you just kind of pretending that you do so that there's stability? The guy's worth $100 million, right? He's getting his face ripped off on Twitter every time he lies to people. He's so conflicted in terms of conflicts of interest with private equity. Yeah. You know, why? And you got Lyle Brainerd, to your point, sitting there with the mother of all doves, Janet Yellen, and Lyle Brainerd. That's a match made in dovish heaven. Like, that would be, you have a fait accompli there. You basically forget about it. Whatever George and I and Rickard's people like us say, forget about it. It won't matter. They're just going to do it.
Yeah. I think investors really need to start thinking about political questions or answering political questions more, or in addition to the economic questions that they're typically grappling with. So I think that taxes are most likely going up. If I'd like to get your opinion on that. And if you agree, how do you think that will affect corporate profits and therefore the S&P over the next, let's say, 2 or 3 years?
Yeah, I mean, they're going up. I mean, they're going to go up, and they're going to go up on you and I, and they're going to go up on anybody who owns anything that's been going up. So that's, again, it's the timing of the tax increase within the cycle that matters. If you raise taxes today, it wouldn't matter, you know, for the next 3 to 6 months. If you raise taxes during an economic slowdown, and it's not just taxes explicitly, like the tax I think you're asking about, you know, just raising taxes, capital gains, et cetera, raising corporate taxes. It's raising my cost of labor. That's a tax. You know, that's right. An explicit tax.
Right.
So I'm gonna make capitalists, this Canadian American capitalist, or you rebel capitalist, you should have made more money in the last, really since June of last year, than you're probably ever gonna make from the pile of cash that you had before, from your pile, right? You just got, there have been oodles of ways to make money. Now you're gonna have to pay on that, and you're gonna be sitting there saying, holy shit, my business is slowing. I have to pay my people more. And that's going to be a big problem. I mean, that's where stagflation becomes a more of a 1970s type issue, George, because when the inflation sticks, the real problem is when workers think next, oh, shit, I can't quit my job and go work over here. I'm going to lose my job and not get one. That's the kind of inflation expectations that we don't have yet. But that was obviously the 1970s. So now you're saving and hoarding because you don't know what tomorrow brings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's a lot of inflation or longer term inflation has to do with psychology. And yeah. That's why it's so difficult to predict, I think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we do have, which again, sad and pathetic for Powell. He cited and like, he got asked about inflation expectations and he's like, well, they're elevated, but it's kind of like, but I don't believe it, but who cares what you believe? You're a lawyer. I mean, you have no track record forecasting anything accurately, but humans are actually pretty good at it. And one of the things we've talked about already, it's not just inflation expectations in the aggregate, which is a Fed survey that has had epic highs beyond any cycle that they've seen recently. But it is people's expectation of the future cost of housing in particular, which is a monster chart. And I don't know how that goes down. I just don't know how that's going to go down unless you have another housing collapse, which clearly this government's not going to allow happen.
Yeah. Okay. I know we're close to a hard stop here, Keith. So last question. I think it's maybe a little atypical. I haven't heard you talk about this too much, but I'd love to get your take on personal freedom. It's something that I've been talking about a lot on my Rebel Capitalist channel, and I think it's under attack right now. And I always say that at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how much gold you have, how much Bitcoin you have, what your stock portfolio looks like. If you don't have freedom, you got nothing. So I'd love to get your take on, the direction it's going here in the quote unquote free world. And then maybe how you're trying to increase or maintain your own freedom in your own life.
Well, I think it's up to all of us individually. Like the best way to, again, perpetuate freedom, particularly freedom of speech and freedom of mobility or free, do it. Get up and do it. Don't whine about it. Don't complain about it. Like my answer to this, I agree with you 100%, by the way. I mean, and what you've really turned this into is this, either this on the one hand, this cover your ass type culture that's all a bunch of bureaucrats telling themselves what they want to say. Or on the other hand, you have people that are just completely polarized, whether it be religiously or maxi style with the Bitcoin. It's like, if you want to do it that way, you're not part of the answer on finding some objective, transparent debates about topics. Like that's, so my small, in my little world, my answer about this, I've started dropping more F-bombs for sure. I started calling these guys and I just, anytime somebody like Powell says, or, this guy Deese, who's a former BlackRock guy, who's chair of whatever Economic Council of Advisors. He said, there's no inflation if you back all this stuff out. I'm like, you're an asshole. These are, I do think that's part of freedom, right? If it takes me having to sound like a hockey player to call these people out, then and to get noticed and more people pay attention, to me, that's the country I came to. It's a country where you're allowed to say whatever you want, when you want, within the bounds of legality, still have a in this case, an empirical opinion on what real world inflation has become, and tell people, look, they're attacking your freedom if they're lying to you. And moreover, legislating with that premise that there's no inflation. That is a lie, right? So we don't want to, so I'm going off a bit like you probably would, but it's a passion that you have to get up in the morning and just reveal it yourself. Try it.
Yeah. And everything, whether it's investing or your personal life, we need free speech, but we also need a free market of ideas. And we need people that are willing to call the shots and call it like it is, really, regardless of any pushback that they may get on Twitter or social media.
Yeah, I think the more pushback we get, the more we're resonating. Okay.
Yeah, you're over the target, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. If you just want to fall in line with a point of view, again, there are preachers that can do that. There are politicians that requires no education, clearly. Or there are like mathematicians and scientists, people that are empirically driven, data driven. And I think, you know, people like you and I having conversations remind people that those conversations are happening. So I do think that that's a big part of freedom, is showing people that there is, you know, that is part of America. It's live and well. It may not get the blow, you know, the blowhorns on Fox or MSNBC, but it's absolutely out there.
Yeah. All right, Keith, I sure appreciate your time, buddy. For my viewers and listeners who want to find out more about what you do or HedgEye, where can they go?
HedgEye.com.
Boy, that was easy.
Thanks, man.
All right, man. Have a great day. Can't wait to do it again.
All right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. I'd like to invite each and every one of you to the next Rebel Capitalist Live event. If you are a fan of the Rebel Capitalist show, I guarantee you, you will love the live event. The next one is Houston, where you can meet and listen to speakers, all your favorites from the Rebel Capitalist show. People such as Dr. Ron Paul, Chris Cole, Lynn Alden, just to name a few. If you want to check out the rest of the speaker list and find out how you can attend, we'll put a link in the description below, or you can just go to rebelcapitalistlive.com. This is an event where you can learn to build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. But it's not just about building wealth. It's about increasing your freedom and networking with like-minded individuals, fellow rebel capitalists. It's an amazing event. I know you'll absolutely love it. Check out rebelcapitalistlive.com, and I will see you in Houston.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.